Thank you. It's a real privilege to be able to give this talk now, and I'm going to be talking just for about 20 minutes or so, and just touching on a wide range of different topics, as I'm hoping to stimulate the discussion, and then there'll be opportunity for quite an extended time for discussion and Q&A. I think it's really interesting that previous technological advances, you think about things like the Industrial Revolution and the invention of electricity and so on, they happened first, and then the creative writers and novelists and dramatists came along second. But what is so fascinating about AI and robotics is that the creative writers got there first. And of course, it can be traced right back to Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. But particularly starting in the post-Second World War era, Asimov writing in 1950, a whole series of novels about on robots, the novels of Philip K. Dick, and a lot of discussion about replicants, sophisticated robots that were so sophisticated you couldn't even know whether they were really human beings or whether they were replicants. And in a very clever twist, the replicants could be implanted with false memories, so the replicants themselves believed they were humans. And so there's this constant blurring between the human and the replicant. Star Trek, investigating many of these themes, including Commander Data, a humanoid robot. Ex Machina, again, about the creation of a humanoid robot. The Humans series on Channel 4 television, and Westworld, again, a series on Channel 4 television, on American television. And so whenever we start to engage with these issues of artificial intelligence technology, it's actually the science fiction tropes which dominate our thinking. And it's impossible really to think about this without all this science fiction present before. It's even more interesting and complex than that, because many of the technologists who are inventing the technology and creating the new innovations are themselves science fiction aficionados. They've been fascinated by SF right from their childhood, and they are consciously or unconsciously trying to make the science fiction come true. So there's a kind of strange alliance between the fiction writers and the technologists. And one of the, of course, recurrent science fiction tropes is the idea that artificial intelligence could pose a threat, an existential threat to the future of humankind. And lo and behold, a number of very eminent people, including Stephen Hawking, warned that this was a very serious threat to take seriously. Elon Musk has argued that to avoid becoming taken over, humans being taken over and oppressed by artificial intelligence, the only hope for us is that we have to learn to merge with the machines. And he's created a company, Neuralink, which is working at how to connect the human brain via very sophisticated wiring to computers. So the fundamental question to ask ourselves is how is our increasing exposure to different forms of AI and robotics, how is it actually changing the way we understand ourselves? We understand this question of what it means to be human. And it is interesting to me that that question has moved from a kind of philosophical exam question for students and academics actually into the mainstream. And it's a question which many people in our society are asking simply because of the extraordinary advances that are going on in our AI, robotics, and other forms of technology. And one of the fascinating things to me is the way that already our working and our personal home lives are becoming increasingly infiltrated by AI-generated simulated persons. And we're all aware of Alexa and Google Home and Siri and so on. Replica is a more sophisticated version of this, whereby you AI system, which you develop a quotes relationship with, you speak to this system repeatedly. It knows everything about you, and then bit by bit, it develops a personality which is specifically matched to you. So here's Replica, the AI companion who cares. And it's just interesting. This is taken from the website. Always here to listen and talk. Always on your side. Create your story together. Your replica will always be by your side, no matter what you're up to. We'll chat about your day, do fun or relaxing activities together, share real life experiences in augmented reality, catch up on video calls, and so much more. And it's fascinating that there are already apparently millions of people across the world who are using Replica and who are speaking about it in sort of very positive terms about this is something that's really helping me. And I think it taps into a sense of relational deficit in our modern society. Many people who feel they find it very difficult to create relationships with other human beings. And here is a system which seems human and which is always friendly, always available. It's never going to get upset or frustrated or push back. And what's not to like to have a friend like that, somebody who seems to care? Even more weird things can happen. And it's people arguing that creating an AI system of somebody who's died is a way of dealing with the bereavement process. It feels like they're still person is still there, and I can talk to them. And mental health applications, there's this psychological therapy for people with depression, delightfully called Wobot, and it provides a continuously available form of therapy on the smartphone. I'm ready to learn 24/7, no couches, no meds, no childhood stuff, just strategies to improve your mood and the occasional joke. And this kind of technology is actually being very widely developed by mental health professionals now and being rolled out across the world. One of the extraordinary things is that it's possible to learn a great deal about someone's mental state from the way they use a smartphone, simply that the way it moved in space, the way that the tone of the voice, the way that the screen is moved, and so on. All of these things can again be used by an AI to monitor someone's mental health status in real time, literally from minute to minute, and then see how they respond to this kind of mental health therapy. Another extraordinary development is the development of virtual influencers. So you're aware of these people who appear on YouTube and have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers. Well, it turns out that it's possible to use virtual influencers. So these are entirely AI generated synthetic people. And actually the manufacturers like them much better than the real influencers because they don't tend to go off message. You can modulate exactly what they say and make sure they give the right branding and so on. And it seems quite likely that virtual influencers will increasingly replace the real human versions. And so then you think, well, what's going on here? That lots of real human beings around the world are watching an AI simulated person and wanting to emulate the way they behave, the way they dress, the makeup they use, the brands, and so on. And deepfakes as well. We may well have heard the way that deepfakes of President Zelensky and of Putin have appeared. And there's a lot of concern among politicians that these very sophisticated ways where you can put into the mouth of a prominent public figure anything you want may well lead to all kinds of political challenges in the future. So again, another example of where there's a kind of blurring between the simulated human and the real human being. And in the Westworld series, in one of the earlier episodes, it's set in the desert in and where a robot theme park is being created with humanoid robots. And the idea is that real human beings can go to the theme park and can live out their dreams. They can do whatever they like. And in one of the early episodes, one of the real human beings is arrived for the first time in the theme park. And this beautiful woman comes up to him and says, "Is there any way I can help you?" And he stares at her and he says, "Are you one of them? Or are you real?" And she says, "If you can't tell, does it matter?" And I think that is a fundamental question which we need to face. If the simulation becomes increasingly so realistic, does it matter that it's all clever programming? And there are, it seems, many people out there who are going to argue, no, it doesn't matter. As long as the experience is indistinguishable from talking to a real human being, the fact that it is a clever simulation is not relevant. I think as Christians, we would want to say, actually, that isn't true, that authenticity is an essential good that we are going to need to fight for, but we're going to need to argue why. Why does it matter? And of course, one of the areas where artificial companions are being promoted and will be increasingly promoted is in the care of the elderly, in care of children, in care of those with mental health difficulties or learning disabilities. And the narrative which is repeatedly expressed is that there are simply not enough human carers available with the increasing number of the elderly and dependent, and we simply have to have technological solutions that are going to help in caring for elderly people and others who are lonely. And then the question is, well, how do we respond to that? Would we want to be cared for by some kind of artificial companion? And if we would not want it, why should we be making this available for others? And one of the paradoxes, isn't it, as machines become more like humans, the humans become more like machines. And we're all aware that often when we're interacting with machines, it seems as though we become roboticized. The machines will only understand us if we speak with a certain roboticized kind of manner to simplify and remove the nuance. And also, it's interesting that these kind of phrases, we talk about people being hardwired, being programmed to obey her parents, suffering from information overload. These are all the ways that the computer machine technology is being used as a metaphor to help us understand more about what it means to be human. This is from China, a screen grab just showing, again, the way that human beings are increasingly seen as data sources. And of course, it's not just in China. This is actually happening across the world. Security services across the world are using face recognition software to monitor us and work out who we are and whether we're in the right place and whether we pose a threat and so on. And a well-known saying of the past, to a man with a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And I think a modern version of that is, to a coder with an algorithm, people look like a rich source of data. There's this kind of depersonalization and the idea that we strip away all the uniquely human characteristics and instead regard people as a source of data. So what does it mean to be a human being in the light of these kind of developments? And is this telling us more about what it means to be human? I think something, again, I'd be very interested to discuss further and to think how this machine and simulated reality, what is distinctive about human beings and where can they not be replaced by simulated versions? I just briefly mention AI and healthcare. A number of you put in the I saw in the Mentimeter that AI in healthcare was likely to lead to improved healthcare outcomes. And certainly there's lots of evidence to suggest that that's the case. It's extraordinary the rate at which AI image analysis, for instance, is now appearing in many, many different areas of medicine. Although it's immediately raising issues, Google DeepMind ran into trouble with the Information Commissioner Officer because of their use of data obtained from the NHS. What's behind the rapid introduction of AI into healthcare? Well, partly it's just through advances in technology. The hardware is becoming incredibly powerful and cheap. Advances in software, which we've heard about, things like deep learning and data analytics. Interestingly, wearable technologies are advancing at an enormous rate, so that it's now possible just to carry something on your arm or on your chest, which is able to give a constant stream of 24/7 data to be analyzed in real time by AI systems. There's accumulation of massive health data sets. It's interesting that the NHS, because it provides a unified health system with millions of people, is seen as a particularly attractive source of data for commercial companies. And of course, that raises all sorts of questions about the commercial interests and whether the NHS is getting good value for money and so on. There's certainly massive commercial investment going in with all the big players and a huge number of commercial startups. And they see, the commercial players see potential profits in healthcare being very large. And also healthcare is seen as ripe for automation. It seems it has very high human staffing levels. It's seen as having inefficient practices, old-fashioned technology, and so on. And so automation in every sphere, but including in healthcare, this is what it offers. It offers increased speed. It offers increased accuracy, increased efficiency. It offers 24/7 operation and rapid scaling and reproduction of effective technology across health systems and around the world. When you consider that once an AI system has been developed that can do a particular task, and this can then be rapidly scaled up, millions of copies of this program can be developed and sent around the world in a way that's simply not possible when we're talking about training human beings and to operate. So there's no doubt that, and this is not just in rich countries, but in many low resource countries, appropriate technology AI has a huge potential for healthcare. And these are some of the very obvious benefits: more accurate diagnosis, rare diseases, image analysis, and so on. Putting greater power and control into the patient's own hands, and the democratization of expert knowledge, so that in theory, with the right kind of smartphone app, you can have access to the kind of expert knowledge which previously only a very small number of experts, and often who are extremely expensive and difficult to access. But of course, as we can all recognize, there are potential adverse effects. In particular, this move away from the individualized face-to-face relationships. So many people, when they are really sick and facing tragedy or facing something extremely threatening, what they most want is a face-to-face relationship with a human being, a wise friend, someone who can advise, who can reassure, and who can say, who knows what it means to suffer, to be afraid, to be in pain. And however sophisticated the AI, however empathic it's programmed to be, quotes, it's a synthetic empathy. And one of the interesting things that happens with technology is that decomposes traditional roles. And so the traditional role of the physician is increasingly being decomposed. And there's lots of jobs that physicians have done in the past can now be done by data engineers and by information technology specialists. But often this has unintended consequences. What is being lost when we lose the traditional clinician role? This is a painting by Fides in 1891, and it shows a physician visiting a desperately sick child at home. And on the right are the parents exhausted. The child is close to death, facing the crisis of some infectious disease, and the physician is just there watching, being present, not bringing some amazing expertise or technology, but just giving his wise counsel and encouragement and presence. And I, as a pediatrician, I find that very moving, because in my own role, I know that sometimes in the most desperate situations, that's all I have to offer is myself as a human being, to support parents and children through the crisis. And one of the problems of AI systems, again, is the so-called black box. And whereas a human physician who makes a diagnostic decision or a therapeutic decision can be challenged and questioned, and why did you make that decision, and how can you explain it to us, when an algorithm says 57% this is the best treatment, it's not possible to interrogate that algorithm and say, well, why? That doesn't seem intuitive, and how appropriate is that in the world of healthcare? Other problems: commercial exploitation, hidden bias, and maintaining quality control. But just as we come to the end, it's not the only question, what does it mean to be a human being? I think just as important as we look to the future are these questions. What kind of world do we want to build for the future? Because technological process has its own momentum. And it's fascinating that when you ask, well, what is the end game? Where are we going? What is all this technology for? It's actually quite difficult to find an answer. It just seems inevitable that we want the next generation, we want the next advance, we want the next possibility for automation. And in particular, techno-optimism seems to create a vision of the future in which intelligent machines and digital technology will enable every aspect of life to become, quote, frictionless. Every desire, every longing, every interest can be satisfied instantly and effortlessly. You don't need to struggle, you don't need to worry, you just press the button. Just, it's there, it's instantaneous, it's all available, instantaneous and frictionless. And yet, is this a future in which physically embodied human beings like you and me can actually flourish and find our purpose and fulfillment? Because the fascinating thing about human beings made in God's image is that in order to flourish and develop, it seems that we need resistance, we need friction, we need struggle, we need frustration, we need pain, we need to develop perseverance. How much we see this in the biblical narrative, this repeated theme of how the people of God are transformed and develop, become the people they were meant to be through the struggle, through the friction, through the frustration and the pain. And so the question I'd like to leave us with, is it possible to envision a future in which this amazingly advanced technology doesn't just create a frictionless future, it creates a future in which we can genuinely flourish, in which we can become the people we were made to be as embodied human beings living in a physical universe? So what does it mean to be a human being, and what kind of world do we want to build for the future and for our children? I certainly don't have easy answers to these, but I think together I'm keen to be part of the conversation. Matt mentioned this book, The Robot Will See You Now. And if you're interested in taking it further, it's a multi-author book with a whole number of different Christians, all Orthodox Christians, giving their perspectives on a wide range of topics, and it's available from SPCK.